welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik, and as you know, the website is redicecreations.com. It's great to have you with us today, as we are going to talk about an upcoming conference in the UK. We have Ian Crane with us, who is behind the Alternative View 2 conference. It takes place at the in London, in Heathrow, at the end of May. And for all of you who know, Heathrow is, of course, close to the airport. So for all of us who are coming from the continent, as it were, as the British would say, it's going to be really kind of convenient. We are going to be there at the conference, Red Ice. We're going to cover it in our own way. And, of course, we hope to see you there as well. And the website that you can go to right now is simply thealternativeview.co.uk. Here you can order tickets, look for more information, and of course read more about the guests. But what we're going to do here today is spend a little time talking about the guests that will be attending, some of the topics that they will be covering, and a little bit about the venue itself. So Ian, great to talk to you again. Thank you very much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for the invitation, Henrik. It's always a pleasure.
You know, I just want to begin here to say that it's going to be a blast to get over again to the UK, visit London again. We were there about a year ago, in about a month's time, and I love these kinds of events. It's great to get some new information, as it were, new people, new material, and of course meet all the speakers, but also all the people that are attending. I think it's so much fun, and I think it's great that you guys are putting this together. So I'm really looking forward to it.
No, we're looking forward to meeting with you guys too, Henrik. And I mean, one of the objectives here is actually to provide an opportunity for people to meet up with like-minded people from, you know, not just the UK, but hopefully from all over the world. I mean, if the first Alternative View event is anything to go by, which we held in the southwest of England last April, I mean, I think we had 14 nationalities represented at the event.
There you go. That's very good.
Hopefully, we'll have even more at this event. And with the dollar-pound exchange rate being rather different than it was a year ago, hopefully the event may also be attractive to some of our colleagues, you know, from the United States.
There you go. Yeah. Very good. And again, as I mentioned, I mean, going to be very close to Heathrow, so it will be very easy to get there. And, you know, I think, is it far from the airport? Is this in the actual airport itself? Where is it?
It's literally right on the periphery of the airport. In fact, the hotel has a prime view right across from Terminal 5. So, yeah, the access is real easy. If you're coming into Heathrow by car, then it's simply a question of coming down the motorway, down the M4, and it's only literally not even 5 minutes off the motorway. If you're coming by train or by plane, then obviously you head to Heathrow Central, and you pick up the bus, the hopper bus, which goes from all the terminals, and it just comes round to the hotel. I mean, you don't even need a cab. In fact, you definitely don't want a cab, because the cab drivers don't want the journey because it's too short. So you have to jump on the bus. Unfortunately, these buses do make a charge. It's a charge of just £4. But literally from the moment that you walk through customs, once you get on the bus, you know, 10 minutes later, you're at the hotel. And it's a really nice hotel. It is a superb facility. I mean, we have a capacity of 700. And you know, we've only had the tickets on sale for 2 weeks, and almost 100 tickets have gone already.
So they're running fast. So
they are. Yeah. I mean, we have block booked rooms at the hotel, because we do want to encourage people to stay at the hotel, because and like I said, you know, we want people to network. We want people to hook up. We want relationships basically to go beyond just this event. You know, we're not looking to form groups or organizations or anything like that. We're simply looking, you know, to find or create a vehicle where people can come together and, you know, share their own thoughts on what's occurring. Because, I mean, as we have discussed before, and I'm sure we'll discuss later, you know, we are at a very, very interesting time in terms of our evolutionary process. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that actually needs to be discussed.
Yeah.
And stuff that's not being discussed in the mainstream media. And that's why we call, you know, the events the Alternative View, because I can pretty much promise you that, you know, the information that is shared at the Alternative View, you're not going to hear it on the BBC.
That's absolutely right. And find the others, as Terence McKenna would say. That's what it's all about, in a sense. And don't, you know, stop caring about what all the closest people in that sense to you might believe or not believe in the things that you are interested in personally. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Again, there are people out there who are interested in what's really going on in the world. And again, these types of events are great to you know, get some new contacts, meet some new friends, possibly, as it were, and just, again, be in an environment like that with a lot of people around. It's going to be really great. And so why don't we talk a little bit about the main, obviously, where people might want to go there for, the speakers, the topics, as it were. You can give us a rundown of who will be attending, some of the names, and we can get into maybe a little bit of what they're we'll be addressing, as it were, Ian.
Sure, sure. I mean, the reason that we have selected an event of this, a venue of this caliber, is so that we can attract sufficient people to be able to pay for very high caliber speakers. And our headline speaker is a guy called Dr. Leonard Horovitz. And Leonard Horovitz is a guy who, if people have heard of him, they've probably read everything he's written and probably seen all the DVDs that he's produced. Or they've never heard of him. I mean, there's almost no gray here. It's black or it's white. and Leonard Horovitz has never spoken in Europe before.
Really?
So, absolutely. It actually surprised me, I must confess.
And yeah,
I did actually
too.
Check with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, you know, I've never actually had the opportunity to speak in Europe. So we said, well, okay, you know, we have to make it worth everybody's while. So how about you give us two presentations? So over the course of the weekend, Dr. Horovitz will be giving two presentations. The first presentation, which he will give on the Saturday, is going to be really a summary of the work that led to the publication of his book, Death in the Air, Globalism, Terrorism, and Toxic Warfare. And this is a book that he published in May of 2001.
Mm.
I mean, just 4 months before the events of 9/11.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody who reads that book will see that, you know, Dr. Horovitz was very insightful. You know, he really did have his finger on the pulse. And I know that he tried to meet with some Senate committees to discuss his concerns, because he was really concerned that the industrial military complex was building up to launch some kind of event to effectively gain greater control over initially the American people and then obviously ultimately on a wider basis.
Yeah.
And you know, he could not get the Senate committees to entertain his ideas. And, of course, 4 months later, we have 9/11, and the rest, as they say, is history.
There you go, yeah.
So he has a very interesting guy, I mean, earlier he'd written a book called Emerging Viruses, and he was looking at the biowarfare and the microbiology. And obviously he touched on the fact that many microbiologists had met rather untimely deaths.
Yes, yes. That's a huge story, that one. Really, really interesting, and I think that I was following that during the time as well. And again, I don't know if that has continued or not, but again, I think that Horowitz did really, really interesting work and to track this down and what the potential reasons are. But yet again, I mean, Horowitz has really had the hand on the pulse, as it were, of the biomedical companies and their crimes against humanity, as it were.
Oh, without any shadow of doubt. And I think it does continue, Henrik, because, I mean, not least, of course, Dr. David Kelly was a microbiologist.
There you go, yeah.
I mean, he was a weapons inspector, but he was a microbiologist.
Yeah.
And then there are some unexplained aspects of a case that you may not be familiar with, but there were two young French students that were murdered in very strange circumstances in London about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it transpired that one of them had been working on bird flu.
Oh, I think I remember this, actually. I don't remember the details, but it rings a bell. It does.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, I mean, obviously, you know, the media, the mainstream media tried to very quickly hush it up and dismiss it as just some random killing in London, like they go on all the time.
Mm.
I mean, anyone would think it was LA. You know, these things don't happen in London very often. But, you know, there's way more to this situation than meets the eye. And hopefully at some point, you know, a researcher will focus on just that issue and you know, look beyond the veneer, as it were.
Yeah.
But Leonard Horovitz has been piecing the jigsaw together for many years. And, you know, one of his later works, which he will touch on the Saturday presentation, is DNA, Pirates of the Sacred Spiral.
Yes.
You know, and obviously what he's alluding to here is the, you know, pernicious agenda of the ruling elite in terms of trying to effectively create the transhuman. And you know, Leonard Horovitz refers to the work of, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who in 1970, when he wrote Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, and in that book, written in 69 and published in 1970, in that book, Brzezinski, who at the time was in his early 40s, actually makes the observation that the challenge for Western governments is going to be to find ways to keep man locked in materialistic consumerism and to stop man from finding his true self.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, again, remarkably, I wouldn't say prescient, because, you know, Brzezinski was one of the scriptwriters.
Well, exactly, yeah.
But, you know, Horovitz brings all this together and shows how it all fits into place.
Mm.
And he comes at it not as a researcher, which is the label that I would sort of flag up myself, but I mean this guy comes at it as a scientist.
Yeah.
And so consequently, he cannot be dismissed. I mean, the mainstream media may try and dismiss him, but the reality is, this guy's research is solid, and it demands, really, you know, sort of greater respect.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, having Len as our headline speaker is a real coup.
Well, it's going to be great, and I think he's going to, I guess, set the overall tone as well for the conference, which at this point, when we look at some of the other speakers and talk more about them later on here, and some of the topics, of course, that they'll be addressing, we can see that it will be leaning towards a GMO health, the Codex Alimentarius, more of topics of those natures, right, Ian?
Yes, I would say that probably 40%, 30 to 40% of the presentations will err towards the issues of health,
yeah,
and the attacks on human health and the restrictions that are being put on people's choices when it comes to health.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, we've discussed before on a couple of occasions now the pernicious agenda of Codex Alimentarius.
Yes.
And a couple of speakers who are very poignant on this area is Dr. Arpad Putztai, who actually came on board onto the speakers list just last week. And Arpad Putztai is a remarkable man. I mean, this is the guy who, in 1998, basically blew the whistle on the GM agenda. And he participated in a television documentary that was due to be broadcast on 10th of October of 1998. And in that documentary, he stated categorically that there was no way that he would ever eat genetically modified foods.
Mm-hmm.
And that observation was based on the research that he had been doing with genetically modified potatoes and using mice and rats, obviously, to determine the effects that the GM products would have on the metabolism of the rats and the mice.
Yes.
And basically, he was very, very concerned by what he found. And I mean, it was effectively changing the whole of the structure of the stomach. And you know, by using rats and mice, obviously you see very quickly the prospect of what will take years to evolve in the human. And this was his observation. This was basically what he was saying. You know, we just don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea. We have no way of knowing what the long-term effects are. And the fact that we're seeing these extremely harmful effects on young mice and young rats should mean that effectively GM foods should not be allowed to enter the food chain.
Right, right.
Which would sound reasonable.
Yes.
There's only one problem, of course, that the biotech industry is very, very powerful. And the result of Dr. Putztai making that observation was that Monsanto, who control about 90% of the GM market, Monsanto contacted Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton called his buddy in 10 Downing Street, Tony Blair. Tony Blair called Philip James, who was the director of the Roa Institute. And a couple of days later, Arpad Putzai was suspended and gagged.
Hmm.
Now, he'd worked, you got to remember, I mean, this guy was, a guy who devoted his life to research at the Roa Institute. You know, he had 30 years with the company. And because basically Tony Blair obviously threatened to pull the funding or whatever, but obviously Philip James did not have the courage or the cojones to support Dr. Putztai. And so Dr. Putztai was effectively fired.
Hmm. How about that?
And, you know, and in the last few weeks, literally, the independent newspaper in the UK has revealed the evidence to show that the European Union has been convening committees in secret, and the task of these committees has been to find ways to introduce GM foods into the European food chain.
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, generally talking well about it. I know that language has been skewed in order to make people more, you know, receptive, as it were, to the positive effects of using GMOs. And of course, again, as we've talked about before, Ian, to put this in the context that this is some way are going to help us now also out of the so-called food crisis that we're kind of semi going through. But we haven't actually heard so much about that now when the economic thing are on the wall. But you know what I mean, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it was last year. And, of course, in the middle of last year, when oil prices pushed up to $147, and as we discussed last year, I mean, it was totally manipulated.
Yeah.
Just as the 1973 oil crisis was manipulated by Henry Kissinger. And in 73, Henry Kissinger used the oil crisis to create a food crisis. And the result of the food crisis in 1973 was effectively the destruction of the American family farm. And most of the family farms were sold up because they, you know, they couldn't live, and they were bought up by big agribusiness. So it created the opportunity for the agribusiness to effectively dominate agriculture in the US.
It's socialism, but in a capitalistic context, in a way.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's capitalistic to the extent of a market, but no competition because it's total domination.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible. Greed. It's fundamental greed.
Yeah.
You know, without any regard for the effect on humanity. And of course, you know, what we also know is that, you know, the number of acres of GM crops grown in the US pre-1980 was a big fat zero. And now, of course, it runs into hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of acres. I mean, all the soy crop in the US is fundamentally genetically modified. And you've got this ludicrous situation in the US where you can still call something or label something as organic if it has up to 10% contamination.
Well, there you go. It's incredible. It's incredible.
It's just outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, in Europe, it's actually 0.9%. So, you know, 1/10 of the contamination of what the US permits and to still be called organic.
Yeah.
So Arpad Putzai, I mean, basically, you know, the guy works in Hungary today. I believe he lectures at the University of Budapest. And obviously he's going to be discussing his experiences at the hands of the biotech industry. And I'm sure he will share with us his current views on GM food and the biotech agenda.
Wonderful. And then, of course, there are a few more people that kind of follow up on this, I guess, and just we'll add more information to this. We have Scott Tipps, for instance. We have Professor Susan Bardos. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but you can correct me on that one, Ian.
No, I can't correct you. I don't know how to pronounce it either. Okay. Bardosh. Yeah, let's
Bardosh.
Say Bardosh.
Okay, right.
To see the spelling, and go to the website.
Yes.
But yes, Susan Bardosh is actually RPAD's partner.
Mm-hmm.
And she also used to work at the Roa Institute. And today she is a full professor of nutrition at Budapest University. And I think the title of her talk is, "Don't put it in unless you know how to take it out."
That's good.
But yeah, there's a 13-year-old boy that's been in the news recently in the UK who fathered a son, and perhaps it would have been advice that he should have followed. But
that's a good one.
Professor Bardosh's talk and area of expertise is on the fact that, you know, with these GM products being released into the biosphere, we have no idea how to control them. You know, she's used the analogy of, you know, nuclear power for a lot of people is pretty scary. And obviously, you know, what occurred in Chernobyl so many years ago now is still very fresh in people's minds. So, you know, we are all very aware of the potential power of an out of control nuclear reaction. But the reality is that, you know, that we know it can happen, but, you know, there are safeguards obviously in place to stop it. And if things do get out of control, there's a very, very good chance you can actually switch it off. You can actually sort of shut down the nuclear reactor. With GM, you can't do that. Basically, once it's in the food chain, we have no idea where it's going, and we have no idea what effect it's going to have. And I mean, the one thing we can probably be pretty sure about is it ain't positive.
Yeah.
And very recently, you know, there was a survey produced by a British university which showed that, you know, the contamination of the water supply in the UK due to a combination of both, you know, GM products, although there's not very much of them in the UK at the moment, but coupled with the pharmaceuticals, and it's having a serious effect on both the plant and the animal life in the waters of the UK.
Yeah.
And one of the effects is that the animal life becomes androgynous.
How about that? Isn't that interesting?
So, You know, consider the possibility that, you know, what may already be in place is a process that is possibly irreversible, unstoppable, which humanity may ultimately wipe itself out through becoming androgynous.
Talk about population control. That must be the ultimate thing. And then obviously to put that in the context of blaming it on, it's an accident, it's chemicals, or the research might even not even go that far if we ever would given a response to why this is happening. It's incredible. And what potentially are taking over this is the whole weird area of transhumanism. We don't need to go there now, but again, just keeping this in the back of our heads, you know, as you let us know this, Ian, here, that this could potentially be the pave way for the, you know, the genetically modified human being and the cloned human being, even, that this will be the only way for us to reproduce, as it were.
Exactly. And, you know, and there are undoubtedly those who would very much like to see that happen, so that they can literally control the type of being that is effectively procreated.
Yeah.
You know, so that effectively it becomes an economic slave. And, you know, doesn't this smack of history repeating itself?
It does. Absolutely.
Yeah. In a very big way. So, you know, there is in the first instance, you know, we must educate ourselves on what is occurring, and we must educate ourselves on, you know, effectively the mentality of the people behind this agenda. And, you know, that brings us to perhaps the third person on the speakers panel, who is leaning towards the food and pharmaceutical and health side, and that's Scott Tipps, who's the president of the National Health Federation in the US. Now, Scott is, as the president of the National Health Federation, also has observer status on the Codex Alimentarius Commission. And the National Health Federation is, in fact, the only consumer health organization that has observer rights on the Codex Alimentarius Commission. So, you know, Scott is an amazing guy. I mean, he attends the as many of the Codex Alimentarius Commission meetings as he can. And, I mean, he knows that basically what he's trying to do is slow the process down as much as he possibly can. Meanwhile, hopefully, you know, people will start to realize what's occurring and start to vote with their feet and probably more importantly, their wallets.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, what is interesting is that Scott is about to launch the European chapter of the National Health Federation, and this will be launched at a meeting in Cowbridge. The information is on my website, on March the 17th, so just under a month from now. And, you know, Scott is totally dependent. I mean, his whole organization is totally dependent on donations from the public. He really doesn't, he's not interested in taking donations from industry because it is a consumer health organization and not an industry representative at Codex.
Mm.
And so Scott is going to talk about his experiences with the Codex Alimentarius Commission. And how it is, and he's going to explain, you know, from his first-hand experience, how it is that the pharmaceutical industry is effectively trying to destroy the complementary and natural health industry.
Mm. Very interesting. It might be good to have a kind of a European outlook on this as well, because I know that the WTO, for instance, have been pressuring the European Union to, you know, allow. They have been critical of GMO and things like that for a while. But then the WTO allegedly have given pressure to Europe to you know, now you must allow, you know, your genetically modified food into your food supply or your food source, as it were. And again, the EU seem to have turned on this issue now and seem to very much be a proponent of it. So we'll see how that pans out, of course. But I think it's good to have a European base out of that. So I'm glad to hear that.
Absolutely. I mean, there is another organization, which is the Alliance for Natural Health. And the Alliance for Natural Health did used to have a seat on the panel at Codex, but now that they have elected not to pursue that route anymore, actually it's very clear cut now because the Alliance for Natural Health is actually addressing the health-related issues, the GM, the complementary natural health-related issues at the EU level, and the National Health Federation is addressing these issues at the Codex level.
Mm.
And in my opinion, both are as important as each other.
Yes.
And what I hope to God that we do not see is any kind of perceived competition as to whether, you know, the National Health Federation addressing Codex or the Alliance for Natural Health addressing the EU, whether one has more potential effect than the other. They are both extremely important, and they both need, you know, consumers' support, which of course starts with having an awareness of what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And you know, Robert Verkerk had his opportunity at AV1 last year in Totnes, and Scott Tipps will have his opportunity to explain his work at AV2 in May.
Wonderful. Really looking forward to hearing more about that. Who else is going to be attending the conference here? Who would you like to begin with? I guess we can mention at this point, if we want to dovetail with the European Union and the whole area of actually common purpose, Brian Gerrish will be there. I think that's great that you got him on board.
Yeah, Brian is an amazing guy. I mean, he has taken, you know, what started as a one-man campaign from his personal experience of this organization called Common Purpose in Plymouth in the southwest of England. And, you know, over the past 3-4 years, his research has probed deeper and deeper and deeper into an organization that claims to be a charity and yet is probably one of the most secretive charities in the world. And to put it into a nutshell, in the US, there's an organization called Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah.
Now, Phi Beta Kappa is a very ancient fraternity. In fact, Phi Beta Kappa was established on December the 5th, 1776. And anecdotally, it was established by people who were frustrated at not being invited to participate in the preparation of the Declaration of Independence. So within the US for the last 240-odd years, there's been some competition within the various fraternities, which obviously have their base in the universities of the US.
Yes.
Now, over the last sort of 40, 50, 60 years, Skull and Bones has achieved the ascendancy in the US. And that's why we see a predominance of Skull and Bonesmen in all senior positions, and of course, up to and including the presidency.
Yep.
But Skull and Bones is uniquely linked with Yale University. And obviously, there's a hell of a lot of very bright, very smart, very able people who attend other Ivy League universities. And the way in which these people are brought into the fold, if you like, is through an organization called Phi Beta Kappa. Now, in the UK, and indeed Europe, we don't have that equivalent. So Common Purpose was established in the late 80s. And what has become very apparent is that the agenda of Common Purpose seems to mirror what Phi Beta Kappa provides in the US. In other words, it identifies people who have the potential to reach senior positions in the industrial, military, political complex and nurture those people, mentor those people. And just as Obama was mentored by Zbigniew Brzezinski for nearly 27 years, so what happens is these people can be mentored right from the age of 14. I mean, Common Purpose even invites schools to identify their best and their brightest.
Yes.
And send them to Common Purpose workshops. And effectively, it's a form of brainwashing.
Yeah.
It's a form of, as Brian calls it, elitist, pro-EU, federalist brainwashing.
Incredible.
And, I mean, of course it sounds outrageous. Of course it sounds crazy. Until you hear what Brian Gerrish has to say, and until you hear the people, and Brian will identify the people who are Common Purpose graduates, and you see the positions that they're operating in. I mean, one of the primary players of Common Purpose who hit the headlines a few years ago was a police officer by the name of Cressida Dick. And she was the officer in charge on the morning that Jean-Charles Menzies was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, as we have seen, the establishment has completely closed ranks around the police and around those who were guilty of his assassination.
Mm.
I mean, the judge that ruled that there was a case to answer, the day after he ruled that there was indeed a case to answer, he was accused of flashing on an underground train.
Really?
Yep. And not once, but twice.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, he had the courage and the temerity to challenge the accusation. And, I mean, he was found not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, what was happening was this was the establishment letting it be known that he come up with the wrong answer.
There you go, exactly. A little minor punishment there, you know. You're on the right track here,
exactly.
Lad. You know,
and the coroner, when they held the coroner court recently, ruled that the jury could not return a verdict of unlawful killing.
Hmm.
Now, this is incredible. Hmm. So the coroner is basically telling the jury that they can only come up with two possible verdicts. One is that the assassination of Jean-Charles Menzies was a lawful killing. And the other version, or the other verdict they could come up with is an open verdict. Well, you know what happened? When the coroner asked the foreman of the jury after they had deliberated and come back with their findings, he said to the foreman of the jury, was the killing lawful? And the foreman of the jury, full credit to him, because this got a complete media blackout, but the foreman of the jury said, no, it was unlawful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is tremendous. But, you know, what we have is, you know, we have this whole series of illustrations of the establishment effectively trying to wield its muscle and closing ranks around the people who were in the key positions. And, you know, really, once it was established that Cressida Dick was a common purpose graduate, mm-hmm. you know, it was a case of, well, no surprise there then. So Brian Gerrish is, in my opinion, a real hero. I actually heard earlier this afternoon, he has been invited onto BBC 5, I believe it is, Radio 5, to conduct an interview about Common Purpose. And, I mean, this is an opportunity for Common Purpose to go mainstream. And if you look at the website, if you Google Common Purpose, I think the first website that comes up is the official Common Purpose website. And the second one that comes up is Brian Gerrish's expose of Common Purpose. Mm, so there's no excuse for people to say they didn't realize that you know, Common Purpose was being challenged.
Very good. I mean, I remember seeing a lecture with Brian and a video, and he talks a bit about that he, you know, encourages people, you know, go and check their website out and then go to mine and check out and correspond. And he's allegedly have been corresponding a little bit back and forth with the people in some kind of involvement with the websites and back and forth. But again, his work is really incredible. And I really like the fact that he also ties it in with the whole European Union and that this is the kind of the umbrella program of this. And this is yes. the common purpose is used to, as you say, Ian, to kind of mold or shape the elitist of those who will be kind of administrating the whole thing behind the scenes or in the individual countries. I know that we even up here in Sweden have a common purpose, for instance, but we never hear about it, and very few people at this point that is involved with it. But it shows that it has its tentacles, as it were, everywhere. So it's really interesting.
Absolutely, and what it is effectively geared to achieve is to weed out the independent thinkers. Because you know, the establishment has no place for the independent thinker.
Yeah.
The establishment needs absolute puppets or intellectual prostitutes, which, of course, many politicians fall into one or other or both of those categories.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so yeah, this is something that we should all very much be concerned about. And you know, we need to know. I mean, if people have been through common purpose training, if they have nothing to hide, why isn't that on their resume?
Yeah.
You know, we should know if an MP or an MEP is a common purpose graduate.
Absolutely. I mean, again, as you say, if it can be, you know, pointed out or proven or however we want to term that, that it is a form of... you know, we of course know about the you know educational system as an indoctrinational tool, of course, but yet again, one level up to this might be the on the common purpose level, that this is about actually indoctrinate and in its own little way then mind control these people to basically fall into line. And if that can be proven out and pointed out, this absolutely is a great, you know, threat. And again, this is really no difference if all the people who are behind the political scene are all like Scientologists, kind of a cult devotion type thing going on here, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, what we have here is a situation of extreme secrecy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because, you know, again, a police chief, you know, we should know whether a police chief is a common purpose graduate. Because what we know is that in addition to the independent thinkers being weeded out, those who are perceived as having the greatest potential are given the opportunity to get their snouts in the trough at a very early stage.
Yes, yes.
You know, so that they become part of the corrupt system. And I mean, I'll give you an example of how corruption can force people to remain quiet. I mean, very recently in the UK, there's been outrage that the Home Office Minister, Jackie Smith, has been effectively proven to be claiming outrageous sums of money, allegedly for her main residence, which she claimed was in London. Yet in reality, she was staying with her sister in London, and mm-hmm. she claimed like £116,000. And then she has the audacity, when she's being questioned, to say, yeah, but I could have claimed more. Well... when it was researched how much more she could have claimed, she could have actually claimed another £58.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So, yeah. So she didn't actually lie. She could indeed have claimed more, but, of course, she wasn't exactly forthcoming with the the full picture.
Well, how nice. You know,
now,
you didn't
here
take
we have
it all.
Here we have an issue of a senior Labour politician, a senior government minister, clearly taking advantage of their position, you know, to the tune of many tens of thousands, if not, well, probably, I think it was just over £100,000. Now, in theory, of course, what we should see is the opposition, the Conservative Party, jumping up and down, saying, oh, this is, you know, this is outrageous. It's sleaze. It's corruption. But they don't say a thing. And the reason they don't say a thing is because they're all at it, too.
There you go. Yeah, well, exactly. The system is perfectly in check, you know, and that's why it's so important to have, you know, have everyone in on it, as it were, because then no one will release that information. And okay, occasionally that actually does happen. Someone is penalized in some way or someone talks out about it. We have these, you know, insiders coming out. So that's very good. But it's very much what I'm thinking of. It's common purpose, if we talk about it, that again, it's a secret society, but in a political context, on the official level at least, that they it's recognized that they can, you know, run policy. They have political influence. They're part of the administrative force within society. Yet it's, as you say, and it's seems to be almost run like a secret society in that sense. And the members, the members list, as it were, seems to be somewhat withheld. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, it is extra governmental in the full sense of the word. So, you know, you have common purpose graduates in your local council, in your county council, in your parliament, in your police force, in your education system, in your local industry. And you know, so consequently, this organization, just like Phi Beta Kappa, has its web. You're reaching out through every aspect of society.
So that's going to be really interesting to hear more from Brian Gerrish about common purpose. And while we're on the subject of political influence and secret societies, I guess we can talk a little bit about Tony Goslin. He, of course, will be a guest speaker at Alternative View 2. And he, of course, is behind the Bilderberg.org website. And he's been covering the Bilderberg Group for a whole lot of years, as I understand it.
Yep, Tony is, without any shadow of doubt, one of the primary researchers into the Bilderbergers. I mean, probably the likes of Daniel Estulin has helped to raise the profile and awareness of the Bilderbergers, as of course has Alex Jones when the Bilderbergers had their meeting in Canada and he was outside the meeting with his infamous bullhorn.
There you go. Yeah.
But Tony's research is solid, and as you rightly say, he runs the website www.bilderberger.org. And at the Alternative View 1 last year, Tony actually played the recording of a telephone conversation that he had with John Reid, who was a previous Home Office Minister. He was Home Office Minister in the UK. And John Reid was in the US at the time, and he was clearly worse the wear for a glass of wine or two. And he obviously, over lunch or dinner, somebody had obviously bent his ear about Tony's website. So Tony, at some 2 o'clock in the morning, British time, had the ex-British Home Office Minister on the phone, asking him to take down his website of Bilderberger.org.
Really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, funnily enough, Tony didn't.
Of course they didn't. Didn't he? Wasn't Tony in some, I don't know if you remember this, but he was in some kind of arrest issue a while back. I think it was last year, you know.
Yes.
I don't know exactly what happened there, but I was reminded of it just the other day when I was searching a little bit more on Tony. But I guess everything is good on that sense, and he's ready to come to the conference, as it were.
Well, actually, Tony will inevitably talk a little bit about the Bilderbergers because that obviously is a core of his research.
Yes.
But he's also going to be addressing basically the total removal of the freedom of the media. And, of course, Tony's recent experiences are a classic example of that. Tony was actually approached by a lady who had some issues, and there was actually, I don't think it was an arrest warrant, but anyway, the police wanted to know her whereabouts. And the police came to know that Tony had met with her. So instead of just knocking on his door, which they could have done, they set up a roadblock on the motorway and stopped him when he was on the motorway. And then they took Tony to the local police station, obviously asked him a few questions, told him that they wanted to search his house. So Tony gave them the keys to his house, but that wasn't good enough. The police wanted to beat the door down. You know, and not only do we have a, you know, a very compliant and complicit media in the UK, but, you know, Estella Rimington, who is the retired head of the MI5 organization, I mean, she has recently come out and stated that, you know, what she perceives is that Britain is descending into a police state. And I know for a fact there are actually many serving police officers who are starting to become very, very concerned about the agenda that they're being asked to carry out. So it is going to be very interesting to see how this unfolds. But yes, in terms of the complicit media, I mean, I have my own experience that, because I was giving a presentation in the north of England just 3 months after the London bombings. And after I'd given my presentation, where I was effectively presenting the evidence that I had accumulated in 3 months, which led me to believe that the alleged perpetrators of the London bombings were in fact innocent of the allegation. And at the end of the evening, this gentleman came up to me and he gave me his business card, and I still have his business card. And he said, Ian, he said, I want to thank you for your presentation tonight. And he said, I have to tell you that I agree with everything you've said tonight. And then he gave me his card, and on his card, he was a senior reporter of the Yorkshire Evening Post, you know, one of the largest circulation newspapers in the north of England. And I said, well, this is great. So when do you write your article? When does your article appear? And he hung his head, he shook his head, and he said, you know, Ian, he said, I did write the article. He said, but I took it to my editor, and my editor called me into his office, and he said, we both know that if this gets published, it's journalistic suicide.
That's so very, you know,
that,
interesting.
That is really an example of you know, the complicit media. And it shouldn't be any surprise to any of us that newspaper sales the world over are falling at a remarkable rate.
Of course they are. Yeah, absolutely. And they deserve it too, you know.
Well, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, any journalist that demonstrates the capability to think independently has no future.
No, exactly. It's it's the same idea all over, and again, it's all about that idea what we talked about before. It's about aligning everyone to the agenda, and again, what is scary here is that this is being done from child level and up now these days. So, you know, except from the few who are interested to understand reality, this is going to go above the radar of most people, and they're not going to even realize that there are being information withheld from them. And again, this can just go on and on. And again, the common purpose agenda of educating people into what is right and what is right to think and how people should think from the, you know, from child level and upwards. It's really, really scary. So I think it's really important again to inform and bring this information out. And as you said before, Ian, that this, it's a good time to do it as well, because a lot of these subjects are converting at this particular point in time. There's health issues, there's media issues, there is, you know, the GMO, the Codex thing. We have the European Union being, you know, just rammed on through every national parliament in the European continent. And so there's so many different areas here. And so we
haven't even spoken about the economic situation yet.
Well, exactly. There you go. Is there anyone that you know that will be addressing that on the conference?
Oh, most definitely there will be. But maybe we come back to that, because from what we were just talking about just now with the complicit media, it's a perfect lead in to one of the other speakers that we have. And this is David Halpin. And David is a very, very remarkable man. I mean, this guy, he's in his late 60s. He might even be 70 now, but he's at that sort of age bracket. He's a retired orthopedic surgeon, a trauma surgeon. And ever since he retired, he has been very proactive in terms of providing support, and I mean physical support, to the Palestinian people. And he made his first trip to Palestine, I think, some almost 10 years ago. And the first trip that he made, he financed himself. So, you know, David put up £100,000 of his own money to effectively hire a vessel, load it with supplies that for schools and hospitals in Palestine, and took it out there. Now, obviously, he realized that, you know, if he wanted to do that again, he wasn't going to be able to keep financing out of his own pocket. So he subsequently established a charity, which is called the Dove and the Dolphin. So David has now been into Palestine, I think, on at least 10 occasions. That's both Gaza and the West Bank. And he's a very, very powerful speaker. I mean, obviously, he's speaking from, you know, direct personal experience. And his experiences were taken to a new level just a few weeks ago when he was a member of the crew on the Dignity. Now, this is the vessel that was sailing from Cyprus to Gaza, loaded with supplies to take to the Palestinian people of Gaza who were being attacked by the Israelis. And David's vessel was rammed by the Israeli Navy. And I spoke to David a few days after he came back from, you know, this experience. And David's a very matter-of-fact guy. You know, I mean, he doesn't, there's no embellishment in David's stories. And, you know, he said, Ian, he said, I had a near-death experience. He said, I really thought I was done for.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, they chose the position very deliberately. He said, we were in one of the deepest parts of the Mediterranean. And had the vessel gone down, and he really does believe that the Israeli vessel was determined to sink them.
Yeah.
He said, had the vessel gone down, you know, it would have been really difficult to ever find any trace of it. And he said, and because of where they were a long, long way from being able to be easily rescued. So he and, I mean, he was with Cynthia McKinney. She was one of the other people on the on the vessel.
Really?
But, I mean, he and all the other people really did think that basically the Israeli vessel was going to effectively kill them.
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, of course, it didn't, the for reasons that we don't know. But thankfully, the Israeli gunboat backed off and the Dignity was able to limp back to port. And of course, you know, what we have seen over the last few weeks, certainly in the UK, and I'm pretty sure it's the case elsewhere in Europe, is appalling bias in the media.
Yeah.
Which manifested in the BBC actually refusing to broadcast an appeal on behalf of the Palestinian peoples. And, you know, so consequently, I mean, our politicians and our media leadership have, beyond any shadow of doubt, demonstrated that effectively their sympathies lie with the genocidal agenda of the Israeli Zionist government.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that you know, when you look at the presentation, people come along and hear the presentation that David will give, and he would talk about his experiences over 10 years working with the Palestinian people. Anybody who suggests that there is not a genocidal agenda here is effectively delusional. You know, there is no question that the Israeli government is not going to stop what it's doing in Gaza and the West Bank until effectively there are no more Palestinians in the country. And although the UN has passed motion after motion after motion, the reality is that Israel just ignores all of the UN's rulings with complete impunity.
Mm.
So David is this is a very, very important speaker at the presentation, and of course, you know, it links in again the wider agenda, because what we see, you know, what we see again is the hard evidence that effectively the global leadership are supporting a genocidal agenda. And if they can do it, you know, with one peoples, in this case the Palestinian, you know, what is to say that they're not prepared to do it on a much broader basis?
Well, absolutely, exactly. You're right. And I think that the overall agenda of the New World Order, which I believe goes back, you know, many thousands of years, this is the way they've been running things, that, you know, just get rid of the population if they don't go, if they're not prone to fit into the ideal that they have of, or the idea of how the new world order and you know how the new unity and oneness of this you know new age planet is going to be run here on after. And that's the way to do it. They did, they just kill people off. The Romans did it. You know the all the crusades that have been going on. So again, this from a historical point of view, this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone really that this is going on.
And it's very unfortunate. Wasn't it Bertrand Russell? I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I'm sure you can find the quote. Later, but I think it was Bertrand Russell who said that in the future, you know, those people who do not conform with the globalist agenda will be put to death. And he said that they will find humane ways to do it, but basically the leadership will have no choice but to do this. And, you know, this is effectively what we can see going on. And that leads us perfectly on to where I can introduce the next speaker. And this is a very interesting individual. It's a guy that I've known for probably about 4 or 5 years now. And I first came across him when I discovered that he'd written a book in 1998 called Mapping the Millennium, The Agenda of the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy called Terry Boardman. And, you know, Terry has done some exceptional research. He's a student. He spent many years studying the works of Rudolf Steiner. So he has a very, very interesting spiritual take on the globalist agenda. And as you rightly say, it's an agenda that goes back many thousands of years. And, you know, Terry has, once again, like Dr. Horowitz, those people who know Terry are very, very familiar with his work. And in my opinion, Terry's work is so important that he needs to have the opportunity to present his work to a wider audience.
Mm.
And hopefully we'll be able to do that at the Alternative View.
Wonderful. I think the quote here, if this is the one you're thinking of, by Bertrand Russell, it says, mathematics takes us still further from what is human into the region of absolute necessity, to which not only the actual world, but every possible world must conform. I don't know if that's the one you're thinking of or not. Could that be the one?
It could be.
Was this more, the one you're thinking of is more, I guess...
It was absolutely more poignant.
It was, yeah. Okay, yeah.
I mean, it was basically the same motivation in the statement, but he was actually taking it further and being very blunt and saying that, you know, he could foresee a time when the New World Order would have to take effectively direct action against those who did not want to conform with their agenda.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll see if we can pick that up later.
We'll find it between us later, for
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely, no problem. Okay, we're very good. So, okay, that's very good. We talked a little bit about Terry Boardman, and then we have a few more others to talk about as well, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, one of the speakers that I've known for quite some time now is a guy called Andy Thomas. And Andy is the guy who has organized the Glastonbury Symposium certainly 10 of the 17 or 18 years that the symposium has been running. And although Andy started his life, as it were, as a crop circle researcher, Andy over the last few years has evolved into a much broader researcher looking, you know, at you know, the political issues, particularly around the erosion of liberty and the lack of truth, you know, within the media. So Andy is doing a presentation where he's looking at specifically Barack Obama and how Barack Obama is effectively been presented as the new Messiah.
Mm.
But in reality, it is effectively going to be more of the same. I mean, Henry Kissinger just a few weeks ago said Barack Obama presents the greatest opportunity for the new world order for many generations.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget, of course, there's Zbigniew Brzezinski, the guy who nurtured Jimmy Carter to the presidency, has also been responsible for nurturing Barack Obama. And it would also be, it's also interesting to note what Zbigniew Brzezinski actually said about controlling the black population of America when he wrote Between Two Ages, nearly 50 years ago.
Mm.
But he has nurtured Barack Obama basically ever since Obama was a student of Brzezinski at Columbia. And so what we have today, you know, is the epitome in America of a quality actor. I mean, George W. Bush was a buffoon. I mean, everybody knew the guy was a buffoon. I mean, you know, he didn't even try and conceal it. Obama is very polished. Obama is effectively a black version of Tony Blair.
Mm.
And Obama, you know, just like Tony Blair, will never permit himself to in any way reveal that he's not making the decisions. I mean, Gordon Brown looks like a broken man right now in the UK because he is a broken man. You know, despite the fact that he served the longest apprenticeship in political history, you know, having lived next door to Tony Blair for 10 years.
Right, right.
When he got next door to number 10, he still had no idea that as the prime minister, he had zero autonomy. So it came as a very, very rude awakening to Gordon Brown, and he's still struggling to come to terms with it. But Obama is going to go through, you know, I think the same rapid learning process. But like Tony Blair, Obama's just going to buy into it, you know, hook, line and sinker. I mean, look at, you know, he's been in power. He's been in office basically, 5 weeks?
Something like that.
And the agenda that's being pursued is arguably, in some respects, even more aggressive than George W. Bush's agenda.
Right, right. Well, I think he's in on from day one in that sense, because he knows what he's doing. And again, I mean, endless articles now have been written about this fact that he brings in the same people that have been in there before. There's no agenda of change from his point of view. I mean, it's the same people behind it. So how could anything change, right, with the same mentality? That's
exactly.
Ridiculous.
but the thing is that the wider population have been totally hoodwinked.
Absolutely.
Into believing that this guy is the new messiah.
Yeah.
And I gave a presentation. Actually, I was with Scott Tipps. And the two of us gave a presentation in Stroud in Gloucestershire a few weeks ago. And unbeknown to us, the local mayor was in the audience. Anyway, during the course of my presentation, I was talking about the GM industry in the US, and I made the observation that, you know, the GM agenda would continue to be accelerated in the US. And to support my view, I said, you only have to look at the people that Barack Obama is bringing around him.
Yeah.
I said, it is going to be more of the same. And the mayor stood up and identified himself as the mayor and basically said, how dare you take away people's hope? Happens, of course, Scott, being an American, was actually able to stand up and obviously support the observation that I was making.
Mm.
And Scott basically just took the guy in about 10 minutes through chapter, line and verse, how the mayor, tragically, had been hoodwinked into believing that things were going to change when the thinking American knew that that was not going to be the case.
Yeah.
So Andy will bring a very entertaining, he's an excellent presenter, very good researcher, and he will bring, you know, a presentation that will certainly set people talking.
Brilliant. So it's very timely and very good to get some Obama expose, as it were. That's awesome. And then we have beyond yourself, of course, Ian, that will be talking at the conference as well. We can talk about that later on. We have two more people that we can talk about that will be attending or speaking.
Well, not least is Helen Sewell, the second lady on the panel. And I saw Helen give a presentation last year. And she's an astrologer. She's a professional astrologer. And I mean, I don't profess to really know anything about astrology at all. It's certainly not anywhere near my area of expertise. But her presentation was truly insightful. And much of what she predicted would happen in the run-up to the year 2012, and the reason that she latched on to 2012 was the fact that, you know, because of everything that's occurring, 2012 was taking much more of a focus in people's psyche. And I think that, you know, this is something that, you know, we need to give more airtime to. We should not dismiss those who have spent their life researching what has been rubbished as a science for, 300 years or so.
Mm.
And I think Helen is a, you know, very interesting lady. She has some very interesting observations, which, of course, are not conjecture on her part, because basically she's taking these observations from her reading of the astrological charts of the next 3 years.
Right, right. That's very interesting.
And so it will be very interesting, and I think it's important that, you know, people perhaps have the opportunity to get a heads up.
Absolutely. Well, that's it's good to balance things out with a more, well, I guess we can call it a bit more metaphysical or a spiritual aspect to the whole time that we're in currently, and that there are some other things going on as well behind the scenes that we might not be prone to think of all the time.
Well, that pretty much encapsulates the, if you like, the mission statement of the alternative view. And although I've sort of expanded upon it on the website, but I was asked to put into one sentence my ethos that I was trying to develop with the alternative view. Mm-hmm. And what I came up with, I said, it's to advance awareness and facilitate discussion of political, scientific, and spiritual alternatives without constraint by consensus reality and or received wisdom.
Mm. Very good.
And so, we have to step outside of the bounds of dogma, and this is what we're trying to do with the alternative view. So, this is not a UFO conference or something of that ilk, and I'm not decrying UFO conferences, but, you know, what we are looking at here ostensibly is very much with our feet ground on the ground, bound in reality. You know, we're not trying to look at the extreme paranormal, supernatural, spiritual realms, but we are looking to see how these worlds interact and interrelate with each other.
Yeah, very good.
And that, of course, is, again, the perfect introduction to the last of the currently named speakers.
Yes.
And that's Adrian Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Adrian will be known to many people because, I mean, he has quite a portfolio of books under his belt. I mean, he's written some excellent books with other authors, with both Robert Bouval, I believe, and Maurice Cottrell. But Adrian first came to my attention when I read The New Jerusalem. And those Red Ice listeners that are familiar with my series of DVD presentations, which I label Project Zion, will know that in the middle DVD, which I recorded in July of 2007, this is the Fool Me Once DVD, I made reference to Adrian's work in the New Jerusalem, where he's looking at London, and he's looking at how, you know, there are a group who know themselves as British Israelis.
Yes.
And they believe that they are the lost tribe of Ephraim.
Hmm.
And how they've effectively contributed to the architecture and the layout of London, and how perhaps they are announcing their agenda within the cartography of the city. So wow. It was very evident to me that Adrian was an outstanding esotericist.
Yes.
And then as I discovered more recently that Adrian's actually in the process of recording a series of presentations, which are going to be available on DVD, where he's looking at the Invisible College. Hmm. And, of course, the Invisible College evolved into what we know today as the Royal Society. Wow. So, you know, just 300-400 years ago, where the Invisible College absolutely took cognizance of the spiritual realm, it evolves into the Royal Society, where, of course, it's effectively endeavoring to completely separate itself from the spiritual realm.
Yeah.
and keep itself and everybody around it sort of bogged down in scientific dogma. Hmm. So Adrian's point is that scientific dogma has effectively become the new religion.
Very interesting. And I guess we can point out also as well, Adrian co-authored The Orion Mystery with Robert Bouval as well, so a lot of people
yes,
will definitely
did.
Know about that one, yeah.
A remarkable guy. I mean, Adrian has really come to the fore. I mean, I've seen him speak now on two or three occasions, and every time I hear Adrian speak, I learn something. I mean, he's one of the speakers who I will always make sure that I'm sitting down to listen to his talks.
Awesome, awesome. So, well, that sounds wonderful. I'm definitely looking forward to – I haven't heard about him before, actually, so this is going to be really nice to listen to his talk. Wonderful.
Yeah, I can assure you, Henrik, he will add to your education. I absolutely promise you.
Wonderful. That's what it's all about. And of course, last but not least, we have you, Ian. What would you be addressing on the conference?
Ah, well, who can say? I mean, it's still 3 months away, and events are changing dramatically.
Yes.
And, I mean, I'm going to actually explore how we have been led into this. And once again, those people who are familiar with my For Me Once presentation will know that in July of 2007, you know, 1 month before Northern Rock folded, I was predicting that, you know, the European housing market was going to crash. And I was predicting that basically the banks were going to go into freefall, and that the economies were going to collapse. Now, I don't claim any special insight. I wasn't the only one. Of course, there were many, many other people who saw it coming.
Sure.
And it's like all things, you know, when you start to participate in a game, after a while, you will get to know the rules of the game. So, you know, you may sit down at a chessboard with no idea how the game is played. But even if your partner or your opponent doesn't explain to you how the game is played, provided you persevere, it's not going to take you too long to understand the basic moves.
Yeah.
And then if you keep at it, eventually you're going to start to be able to predict his moves, and you're going to be able to then give the guy a real game. Well, this is what's happening, I think, you know, more and more with contemporary researchers. It is a game where the rules do change. The rules do change very regularly, and it's perhaps a bit like three-dimensional chess.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by engaging in the game, we can actually, you know, have some insight as to what is probably coming down the track.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously there were many books written on it, but because obviously the template was there, this is exactly what had occurred in, you know, the run-up to previous recessions and depressions. Well, as you will be aware, I also talk about other manufactured trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've uncovered, obviously, documents, right-wing think tank documents from the 60s, where they talk about introducing climate change as an alternative to war to keep the masses occupied.
Yeah, yeah.
Peak oil is another, you know, manipulated crisis. The food industry, the food crisis is manipulated. You know, Kissinger in 73 to destroy the American farmer. The food crisis as is being presented now to introduce GM foods. These are all manufactured crises. And basically what I'm going to be talking about at the Alternative View is trying to give people some insight into how they can predict what's occurring and what action perhaps they need to take. Because unfortunately, what a lot of people do, even though they see it coming, they don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, when I saw the housing crash coming, I said to my wife, I said, you know, basically, if we are thinking about moving anytime in the next 10 years, we need to sell our house.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we want to have the flexibility to move, point one, we don't want to be caught in a situation where we just can't sell the house. And secondly, we don't want to be caught in a situation where our primary asset is falling in value.
Yeah.
So, you know, we sold the house. We sold our house in October of 2007, just at the right moment. And again, I don't claim any special insight here, but we saw what was coming and then we took action.
Yes.
And I've got other friends who said, yeah, well, we saw it coming in, but you know, we just decided we'd sit tight.
Yeah.
And now they're hurting like crazy.
Yeah.
You know, another colleague of mine, you know, came to me a few weeks ago and, you know, shared, you know, his personal situation. And he bought a house in the UK in 1996 for £40,000. Now, he's still in that house. So in theory, he should be in very good shape.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is that he has a mortgage of £300,000.
Oops.
And this epitomizes what has occurred, because this artificial increase of property values has been created by making money easily available. And of course, it's money that doesn't really exist. It just exists on a computer.
Yeah.
But what's been happening is this money has been fed to people on the back of their supposed increase in value in their property price. They've spent the money, so the money has sort of, helped to sort of maintain this massive rise of consumerism. But now everything's crashed. Obviously, he's in a whole world of hurt because he's in a house that definitely isn't worth $300,000 now. But he's got a £300,000 mortgage. He's got that liability to pay off. So he's got that liability. Plus, of course, it means that he's got far less disposable income than he's had available for the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
So this really wasn't particularly smart. And as I said, in fact, I don't know if you saw my presentation in Liverpool, because I think you guys were interviewing somebody outside.
Yes.
But I said last year, everybody needs to think very carefully about what's coming. And people need to start getting themselves out of debt. They need to start cutting up their credit cards. And people need to start living, like people lived 40, 50 years ago, which is if you didn't have the money, you didn't buy anything.
Right, right, yeah.
You didn't use the credit. So anyway, what we're going to do, what I'm going to try and do at the Alternative View, is explain, some of the pointers. And people will be able to see for themselves what's occurred. And then we'll start to take a look at, some of the things that we foresee coming over the next 12 to 24 months.
Very good. So it's a very good spectrum here, as it were, of different topics. And again, with very much focus on the health issues, GMO codex and natural health and so forth. But again, many different areas. And that's a very good rundown and a thorough description of the speakers and the topics that will be covered during the conference. So why don't we, Ian, talk a little bit about dates, times, and
okay.
How people will go about, getting tickets and so forth for those who are interested in attending.
Okay. Well, first of all, Henrik, I mean, hopefully you're going to have the opportunity to speak to some of these people in the coming weeks. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. We're going to invite, we have Len Horowitz coming on the program here in a week or a week and a half, something like that. And hopefully we'll be getting Brian Gerrish on. And I know that you'll be getting a few more names and contact infos out to me so we can talk to some more of these people and bring them on and talk to them more about the research and highlight that. So that's going to be very good, I think, to dive into it even more here on our program as well.
And in Europe, I understand that Edge Media TV are going to be broadcasting Len Horowitz's documentary, In Lies We Trust. And I think they're going to be broadcasting that in sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So people can look out for that as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. That's great.
That's Sky Channel 200.
Sky Channel 200. And do you have their website on the top of your head that you can mention for people?
It's edgemediatv.com.
Okay, very good.
Edgemediatv, all one word, .com.
Very good. Excellent. So let's see here.
Dates.
Yeah, absolutely. Dates and times and so forth.
Right. Well, the dates are, it's the last weekend in May. It's the 29th, 30th, and 31st of May. The conference itself will start at 7:30 on the Friday evening. Registration will start from about 5 o'clock, so people can start arriving at the hotel really any time after about 2 o'clock. Register for the event at 5, and then the event itself will kick off at 7:30. On the Friday evening, it'll run through till about 11 o'clock. And then on Saturday and Sunday, both days will be starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. On the Sunday evening, there will be two events in the Sunday evening. The first one will finish at 9 for all those people who have to travel home on the Sunday. But there will be another event that will go on to 11 o'clock.
Mm.
And, of course, one of the benefits of being in the hotel and being resident in the hotel is that people can actually sit in the bar for as long as they like.
Very nice. Very nice.
Although only on the Sunday night. Not on the Friday night and Saturday night, please, because they have to get up early.
Well, exactly. There you go.
We want all of our speakers to have a good audience, not not the first speaker only having half a hall.
There you go. Exactly.
The venue itself is very special. It's a perfect airport hotel. It's only on two floors, so there's no elevators. One flight of stairs. I mean, so half the rooms are on the ground floor. So anybody who has any access issues, when they're booking, they just let us know and we make sure that they're on the ground floor. We also spent a long time meeting with the hotel and discussing such things as the menus.
Yes, yes.
Because obviously a lot of our people, I mean, we know that, you know, at least one set of people actually have a raw food diet.
Yeah.
But many of our delegates, you know, certainly have vegan or vegetarian needs, or they have allergies. And the hotel have been incredibly cooperative. So there will be, certainly all the breakfast foods will be organic. And if they're not, they'll be clearly marked. But the hotel is committed to do everything it possibly can to ensure that all the breakfast produce is organic. There will be organic, vegetarian, vegan options on all the lunch and dinner menus. There'll be soy milk available for those who want soy milk in their tea or coffee. All the tea and coffee will be fair trade. So yeah, I have to say, we have found the Thistle Hotel to be very supportive of, you know, what we're trying to achieve here. And also in terms of the pricing, I mean, this is a very good quality hotel. And we have the packages of 3 nights. For anyone sharing a room for bed and breakfast, let me get it absolutely right. I'm just doing a double check here myself.
Yes, no worries. Right.
So for bed and breakfast, for 3 nights, it works out at £35 per person per night sharing. Mm. So in other words, they have the potential to have 3 nights bed and breakfast for a total of £105. And although, unfortunately, we've passed the early bird date of the conference, until March the 20th, until Friday, March the 20th, we have the saver pricing. So the bronze ticket is currently £94. So anybody booking before March the 20th can actually get 3 nights bed and breakfast and the conference ticket for £199. And I think that's a pretty good value deal.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
I mean, if people have single occupancy, it's more expensive. For single occupancy, it's working out at £60 a night. There's also the option of bed, breakfast, and evening meal, because those who book their evening meal in advance, you know, will have the opportunity of the buffet in the main restaurant. Those people who don't book their evening meal will obviously have to make their own arrangements. There are other restaurants in the hotel. There's an a la carte restaurant, or there's bar stacks. We've also spoken to the hotel, and obviously we want to make sure people do stay at the hotel. We don't want people to be encouraged to wander off because the beer prices are cheaper down the road. So the hotel has agreed to offer, you know, basically a range of beers and spirits at the same prices as the local pub. Because, like I said, we want people to actually network and, you know, share their experiences, share their ideas, and hopefully build relationships that go way beyond AV2.
Yes. Well, that's wonderful. I'm really glad to hear about the food arrangements as well. It sounds really, really good that you guys have managed to do that, because that can be tricky sometimes, as you say, for people who are aware of what they put into their bodies, as it were. And so that's excellent. And I guess, you know, from here, in that sense, the best way to go about this now is go to thealternativeview.co.uk and check out, because again, there's more information there. And I guess that people can, if they want to order a ticket, they can do that straight away from the website. Is that correct?
They can do. There's also a shorthand version of the URL. So thealternativeview.co.uk is the longhand version. The shorthand version is www.avll.co.uk. And just in case anybody gets confused, AV11 or avii.co.uk will also get you there.
Oh, okay, very good.
So that's the shorthand version, so you don't have to type out the whole word.
Absolutely.
So avll.co.uk, and that will take you straight to the website. And as you say, you can book online. For anybody who, for whatever reason, is not comfortable booking online, you can phone us on 0207 558 8869, and we can take your booking over the phone.
Give us that number again, yeah.
It's 0207 558 8869.
Very good. We will have that up on our website as well, and of course all the links and so forth. And you know, Ian, I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to this. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's going to be great to get over to London again, and it seems to be very good arrangements with the hotel, and everything is going to be closed, so we'll not be anything running back and forth all the time or what have you. So the this is really going to be great. Is there anything more, Ian, that you'd like to mention that we haven't touched upon so far?
No, I think we just sum up and say that you know, we may have all the arrangements in place, but what makes the event a success is obviously people coming to it. Yes. I mean, you know, the prices are as low as they are. I know some people have shared with us their concern at the price, but you know, it is not realistic to put on an event of this caliber, you know, for an entrance fee of £5 or £10. You know, and that's why we're trying to absolutely ensure that people get value for money.
Yeah.
You know, by bringing speakers like Dr. Leonard Horowitz, like Dr. Arpad Putzai, like Professor Susan Bardosh, you know, who they wouldn't normally have the opportunity to see, and certainly not at one event. So, you know, I think all in all, we're very comfortable that what we've put together here is a package that all in all is one of outstanding value. But most importantly, you know, say the event has been created because we want to use this as a foundation for effectively establishing an alternative view community.
Excellent. I think that's a great idea. And again, I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a pleasure to see you there, Ian, many of the speakers, and of course, hopefully a lot of people that are listening as well tune in. And as some of you might have been attending the Beyond Knowledge conference, for instance, last year that we attended, and would love to see some of the same faces there again. And if there's new people, so to speak, that are tuning in as well and didn't get a chance to go there, here's a second chance to get over there and visit the UK and have a good time over there. So, Ian, it's going to be great, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, we are too, Henrik. It's going to be an amazing event. We're really pleased that you guys are coming over. The Edge Media TV crew are going to be there. They're going to be supporting the event by live mixing the presentations and recording the presentations. And, I mean, there will be a DVD set available from the event sometime afterwards. But also, Edge Media are going to broadcast all of the presentations at a later date, you know, as and when they've had the opportunity to do any necessary editing or whatever.
Yes, yes.
But, of course, this ensures that the alternative view basically goes way beyond the Thistle Hotel. You know, and potentially we have an opportunity with Edge Media, with Red Ice, and, of course, all the delegates to really spread the word that there are alternative ways of living our lives rather than the economic slavery that those who believe that they are the rightful rulers of a global fiefdom would have us live.
Yes, absolutely. And this is where it begins. It begins with the information and then begin to you know, work together, as it were, in the best way that people are comfortable with other people, and just, as you say, and build the networks, as it were. So with that, thank you very much, Ian, for coming on, sharing this information with us. And again, hopefully we'll see a lot of you guys there, and we'll see each other there, Ian.
Absolutely, Henrik. I'm looking forward to it.